Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. These days, there is a coach for everything. Life coach, dating coach, organizing coach, and of course, a financial coach. We're going to talk about one approach founded by U.S. money expert Dave Ramsey. His company trains coaches all across North America, and those coaches often work in connection with faith-based communities, in particular Christian communities. We're going to talk to Chris Hogan, a member of the Ramsey team, about this approach. Now, financial coaches can help you with your financial planning, but when it's time to buy a new house, you may want to consult with a mortgage broker. But before you do, you should understand how mortgage brokers get paid. Mortgage broker James Armstrong will tell us how that works and point out what he sees as some potential conflicts of interest. Speaking of conflict, sometimes that happens in a marriage, and in worst case, it can lead to divorce. Now, there are some obvious steps to take to separate your lives if that's the circumstance you're in, but there are also some less obvious ones, like changing your Apple ID and dividing up your loyalty rewards. Family lawyer Laura Paris from Shulman Law Firm will be here to tell us about some of the other accounts you'll need to deal with. And we'll find out what happens when you mix psychology and economics. BE Works Senior Associate Michelle Hilscher will be here to tell us how behavioral economics can help you stay out of debt. And finally, have you ever heard of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations? It's a kind of a phrase or a parable. Krista Kerr, CEO and president of Kerr Financial, will talk about what the phrase means and how families can reduce the risk of this happening to them. All that is ahead. Let's get started. You've heard of accountants and financial advisors, but what about financial coaches? Dave Ramsey is an author and creator of Financial Peace University, and they offer this Financial Coast Master Training for people interested in becoming a financial coach. Chris Hogan is a member of the Dave Ramsey team, and he's here to tell us more about financial coaching and how it might connect to a faith-based community. He joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Hello there.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I drove by this rural church in southwestern Ontario a couple weeks ago and saw a sign for financial coaches outside the church. I want to start by asking you about this fit, because on our program in the past, we've talked about financial coaching, but we've never made the link between that sort of financial framework and people who have a deep connection to faith. What is that link?
Well, I think it's really they're having this mindset of understanding with money, we don't own it. Our job is to be good stewards, which simply means to be a good manager. And so whenever you start to think about this, about how do you deal more effectively with your money, I kind of use the example. It's almost like how do you get into better shape, right? Like you can buy some weights and work out at home, or you can join a gym, or you can join a gym and get a personal trainer. In that analogy, a financial coach would act as a personal trainer for your money. So it helps you in your direct own personal situation.
And in Canada, there's a brand called Money Coaches Canada. People, you know, they can hire money coaches. But what I think is interesting about this method is that Ramsey has really developed relationships with people in faith-based communities. How did that come to be? And what has that be a little bit different than if someone just picked up the phone and booked a money coach they saw online?
Well, I think, you know, the key is with us, we are founded as a company on biblical principles. We are almost 850 team members large now. But this started with Dave helping people in his own local church. After he lost all of his money and worked hard to build it back up the right way, he wanted other people to prevent that, to avoid the pain that he felt. So he started the class in his church, helping people understand how to budget. How do you get out of debt? How do you deal with money the right way? So this is where it all started, and it just grew as we grew as a company.
What is the community aspect in terms of your particular approach to financial coaching? And I ask because for people, I went to church as a kid. I don't today, but I did as a kid. And there really is a community essence. There's support. There's ideas that come from being in that community. How does that connect to money?
Well, I think the main thing is understanding that, you know, life is about community. Whether you grew up in a neighborhood or community or you went to church, you know, we're used to being around people. I don't think life is meant to be done alone. But when you're around like-minded people, something really unique starts to happen. You start to share life with them. You start to cheer them on in their times of triumph, and you're able to support them in their hard times as well. And so with this, especially especially looking at the financial coaching, what we're trying to do is to make sure we've got a group of people out there that are committed to helping people the way that Dave and I teach, and they're going to guide people properly. There's a phrase that we use that really sets us apart, and it's heart of a teacher. Someone with the heart of a teacher is someone that's helping you understand and navigate. Someone that has the heart of a salesperson is simply trying to sell you stuff. So we're trying to come around people to properly guide them and aid them as and how they deal with their money.
If I was a fly on a wall of a program that one of your team members was delivering, what would I see? How does it work? Are there rituals associated with it? How long does it last? What are some of the things that you talk about?
Are you referring to Financial Peace University?
Yeah, so something that someone would register in and go to might be held in a church basement.
Okay. Well, the Financial Peace University is held in churches, but this is where people are coming in and they're wanting to know how to deal with money. So essentially what happens is there's a lesson that's played, then there's group discussion. So you've got people in there that are single, newly married, newly single, or long-time married, but they're wanting to get better with their money. So they're coming in, they're hearing lessons on budgeting, dealing with debt, how to buy a home the right way, the importance of insurance. So these people are in a classroom setting, in a small group kind of area, learning about money. So it's great. It's an open environment where people are able to ask questions and really able to connect and cheer each other on.
Is it a particular faith that this works well with? Like, how does the biblical element manifest itself in the program? If someone follows a different faith, does it work, or do they need a completely different program?
Well, we're based on biblical foundations, but Financial Peace University, it's a 9-week course, but it's not a prerequisite that someone is a Christian. Someone can come in and learn about money. We have people of all faiths come in because money is that unique thing that we all have to deal with, regardless of your denomination or your stance with faith. And so, no, it's not a prerequisite. Financial Peace University is for anyone that wants to improve their money situation or learn how to handle it better.
What are some of the things that trains financial coaches in the Ramsey approach? And I ask because it's not a regulated term. It's not like, ooh, I'm a medical doctor and I pass this particular exam, or I'm a, you know, chartered professional accountant or whatever. How do you ensure that they are delivering the material and delivering the services in a way that's consistent with what you intend?
Sure. Well, it's twofold. I am actually the instructor for the course of training the financial coaches. This is a training that is all done online. It's called Financial Coach Master Training Online, and it's an ongoing, it's a rigorous training agenda, you know, where we're walking through guiding them on budgeting, how to work with people dealing with debt, insurance, real estate. But the fine line is this: we're not there to sell any kind of product or any kind of financial service. We're there to guide people, like that personal trainer example, with someone trying to get in better shape. And so there's an agreement that they all sign that they agree not to sell products, not to cross that line. We refer people to investment professionals, tax professionals, all of those people. We know our role. Our role is to coach and guide people. The professional's role is to be able to give them that specific advice on their taxes or their investments.
How do you charge for these services? I mean, there's obviously the university component, so you're selling a piece of training. And then how do the coaches themselves charge for their services?
Yes. So with the coaches, they come through the training, they go out and they set up, they're like individual business owners. They set up their own payment structure and how they're working with people in their own packages. So we train them, they go out to run their business and design it on their end. So that's entirely up to the coach that is out there in the community.
I know you offer this the training program to Canadians because I see them, you know, offering these services here. But how do you customize by geography? Obviously, there are some differences between Canada and the U.S., and I assume in even regionally, there are differences in terms of how people think about money and behave around money. How do you account for those?
Well, I can tell you this, having been, you know, working with money for almost 25 years and as a financial coach for 13 of those years, I've traveled and worked with people all across the world. And I can tell you this, the components that we teach about budgeting, dealing with debt, wanting to make sure you have insurance, saving for your future, it's universal. There's nothing that's different between the United States versus Canada versus China versus anywhere else. You have people that are wanting to know and needing guidance. Now, the different nuances come with investing. as we all know, there are differences for Canadian investing versus U.S.-based investing. That's why we have people refer to those investment professionals in the area. So what we're teaching people are the basic tenets of dealing with money. Budgeting, debt, insurance, real estate, that's what we do from the high level and a personal level with that person.
There are many different things that people need to become at least competent in as it relates to money over the course of their lives. If there was one single behavior that you could, I don't know, magically or through divine intervention alter in society at large, what would it be?
Budgeting. If I could universally give people the skill of budgeting and understanding how to control their money, I think it would make a drastic change in people's lives.
Very interesting. Well, Chris, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Chris Hogan is a part of the Dave Ramsey team, and one of the things that they offer is called the Financial Coach Master Training. He joined us today from Nashville, Tennessee.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you're looking to buy a new house, you are most likely going to consult with a mortgage professional, sometimes through a bank or a credit union, and sometimes with a mortgage broker. Now, of course, the broker should get paid, does get paid, but how do they get paid? And how does that compensation affect the products they sell? Mortgage broker Jason Armstrong is here to talk to us about how that actually works and how some potential conflicts of interests can arise. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Bruce.
So let's start with the very basics. At its simplest, in its simplest way, how does a mortgage broker get paid?
So once the file has been funded, the lender who has funded the file pays us our mortgage brokerage compensation, and then part of that compensation gets paid to us directly.
So if I have borrowed, say, $400,000, whatever, say $500,000, how much does your firm get?
So that depends on several different factors.
Okay. Give me the simple answer because we're going to get into more detail.
So an easy calculation would be 1% of that. So on a $500,000 mortgage, we're going to make approximately $5,000.
Okay. Now, there's lots of nuance, and that really is the essence of our conversation here. You wrote an opinion piece on this topic, and you argued that mortgage brokers can't be unbiased or impartial. Why is that?
Because we have a direct impact on how much commission we make depending on the product that we do sell. So you asked how much commission we'd make on a $500,000 mortgage. Well, that depends on several different factors, right? So if that's a five-year term, we're going to make a little bit more than if it was a two-year term.
So the four that you flagged, term, lender, conditions, and rate. So let's start with term. Five-year is definitely the most common. Why would a mortgage broker – what would be – the downside to a borrower to get anything less than a five-year? Tell me about the disconnect, the potential disconnect between that being where the mortgage broker will make the most money and what wouldn't work so well for the borrower.
So if the interest rates are on a decline, then you want to go into a shorter term mortgage, a 2 or 3 year term, so you're not locked in for a longer period of time. But in nowadays, when the mortgage rates are on the incline, you actually want to look at that five-year term as a positive because now you're locking in before the rates do go up, if they do go up. But nobody has that magic ball to understand fully whether they're going to increase or decrease.
What's the difference ballpark in comp on a two-year versus a five-year?
About 50%.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. So it's pretty significant.
Exactly.
How do mortgage brokers get trained in working with clients to balance the needs that they have and the comp that they're offered from lenders?
So a lot of that will be depending on the firm or brokerage that you work with. So each brokerage will have their own independent training sessions. Mortgage Professionals Canada, one of our associations, does their training as well. And your local teams as well will do additional training.
The second factor is lender. There is a perception out there that mortgage brokers shop around. They shop like from coast to coast to coast. They're shopping around for the best deal for you. What you're saying is that some mortgage brokers work primarily with one, maybe two different lenders. And they do that, I assume, because they want to hit volume bonuses for a particular reason for additional comp. Tell us why a mortgage broker wouldn't shop around from coast to coast to coast and would work with a shorter list of lenders.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to product knowledge, right? So I don't have the resources available, and most brokers don't have the resources available to know every single product offered by every single lender. So this year, I've worked with approximately 7 different lenders, and I don't know every single lender's unique products. So I can't really say that I shop around to every lender available. I shop around to the lenders that I'm aware of, and I know their products intimately.
What about the volume thing?
So we are compensated more heavily if we send volume to a particular lender.
Right. And does that – they, you know, you get an email with this month's special. If you send us $1 million worth of business, we'll give you a free Hatchimal.
Yeah, so
and a pizza party.
So every lender is going to be different with how they calculate their volume bonuses. So some lenders, for example, will have an annual commitment that we reach, and some lenders will have different promotions given their seasonality of their financing.
So how do you determine which ones you're going to work with and which ones you aren't going to work with?
So it's much easier to work with a niche product. So I do a lot of refinances. So as a result, there's only a couple lenders that are really, really competitive in the refinance space. So some brokers are really heavily into rental properties, right? So they'll deal with a couple of different lenders that I may never deal with.
Mm. Conditions is one of the other factors, which can be really important to a borrower. Things like prepayments or break fees or payment vacations. How does that link to compensation?
So it links to compensation, and it's kind of connected with the rate, right? So we can offer a stripped out mortgage based on very little conditions. So my particular mortgage is what I refer to as a low rate basic, right? So I have very, very few conditions included in that. I can port the mortgage, but I can't refinance with a different lender. I can only pay out the mortgage in full. It has a bona fide sales clause. So if I sell that property, I can pay the mortgage out. But otherwise, I'm fairly limited on what I can do. It tends to have a lower rate with the same amount of commission associated to that, right? So if I'm competing against another broker, I have the ability to say, well, I can beat that rate, but they may not fully understand that I'm beating that because I'm stripping out some of their flexibility.
I see.
And long-term implications of that.
The last variable is rate, which I know is where many people start and they get super focused on the rate. How does the rate link to comp?
So standard products that we're offering will give us the full rate full commission from a particular lender. We have the ability to reduce our commission at a cost of our we have the ability to reduce the rate at a cost of our commission.
Right. So some and what would have you do that? Is it the weeping client, the demanding client, the client you like, the client you feel sorry for, the client who's going to bring you an extra couple $1 million of business because they're such a good referral generator?
So every broker is going to be a little bit different in the service and the value that they add to the client. There are a lot of brokers that have a business based solely on volume that they buy down a lot of the rates. So they are competitive on the rate, right? Where I try to add a little bit more value and to my customer and don't necessarily buy down that rate.
This European piece appeared in Mortgage Broker News. What sort of feedback have you gotten on it from your peers?
I've gotten positive and negative feedback.
What's been the negative?
Well, it's a very controversial topic. Anytime that we're questioning commission and compensation, some people think that it's attacking them. When I don't believe that it's attacking anybody, I just think that if you're offering a value to your clients, what does the commission matter, right? It shouldn't really make any difference.
And you no longer track it in your practice.
Correct.
How did you – what was the insight that had you make that choice?
Because I don't want to make a decision that impacts my commission one way or another. I want to make the decision that's best for the client, regardless of how much I'm going to make on that file.
What advice would you give to your very best friend in the world who's looking for a mortgage who, for whatever reason, is unable to work with you? So they are only coming to you for whispered pieces of advice on how to find the best mortgage for them in all of those variables that you've talked about. What advice would you have? Because all of my listeners are going out there into the great, wild, wonderful world and trying to do this on their own.
Ask the right questions. Do a little bit of homework. Don't hesitate to give me a call because I don't always have the best product for that customer, and I will send them back to the location that does have the best product.
Interesting. Jason, thanks very much for your insight. We appreciate it.
Thank you kindly.
Jason Armstrong is a mortgage broker. He was here to talk about how mortgage brokers get compensated and the potential for conflicts of interest. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, how to eliminate debt. We're going to talk to Michelle Hilscher from BE Works. And later, Shulman Law Firm's Laura Paris will be here. She's going to tell us about some of the other accounts you might want to separate as you go through a divorce. Now, if you have any questions about money, I have no experience on the divorce front, thankfully, but I might have written something on those questions. I'm the money columnist for Money Sense. You can find out stuff that I have done at moneysense.ca. Search for me. Stay with us. We'll be right back on Moolala.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Most people know they need to earn more than they spend to stay out of debt, but often don't do what they know they're supposed to do. And that's at least partly to do with psychology. Michelle Hilscher is with a firm called BE Works, and she's here to talk about behavioral economics and, in particular, techniques we can use to almost outsmart our brain and help us eliminate debt. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there.
So we talk about behavioral economics a lot, but for those who are new to this, how do you describe it? What would you say to someone at a dinner party when they said, what do you do?
Absolutely. It's an interesting answer that I give. So it's one of those things where it's a mix of behavioral science and management consulting, and it's understanding how people make decisions in a way that's, you know, more about the biases that are actually happening under the surface.
Our brains are so fascinating.
They are.
We know that household debt in this country is very, very high. We know that 42% of credit card holders do not pay their card off in full every month. And sure, there are circumstances like housing costs and an uncertain job market. But for you, what are the biggest behavioral economics principles that apply to this question of outstanding consumer debt in particular?
Absolutely. So there are a number of different biases that are explaining how people actually think about borrowing and then ultimately what they do when it comes to balancing spending and maybe paying off what they owe. And I think that one crucial barrier that a lot of research has investigated so far has to do with our optimism around what we're going to do in the future. And there's really interesting research out of the United States, actually, showing that people are very optimistic and they don't actually think that they're going to be a debtor. They don't actually think they're going to owe money to, you know, to a company. And so because of that, when they're making that initial decision of around what the product should be, the credit card perhaps that they're acquiring, they focus on the wrong things. So they might look at, you know, can I get the ultimate lowest annual fee, as opposed to knowing that down the road I will actually use this card and therefore perhaps prioritize something that's more important, which would be how much are you actually paying interest-wise.
Tell us about, so I love the optimism thing because I am a deeply optimistic person and it is a great part of my character in some ways. And I can see how in the context of debt, it would not be a great part of some people's personality. Tell us about, define present bias and link that specifically to the debt question.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you are present biased, what you're doing is really focusing on how it feels in the moment and not really, you know, emphasizing in your mind what it's going to be like down the road. And we're very naturally doing that. There is also some work by Hal Hirschfield, actually. He's a colleague of ours, a behavioral scientist, looking at how we feel about our future self. And it reveals that we are actually looking at that future self as though they are a stranger. We feel no empathy for them. So it's very difficult not only to realize that there's going to be things they need, but to then prioritize that need over what we want right now.
You have this incredible amount of knowledge about how our minds work, and I want you to bring that to a very practical question. Let's say you were coaching my very best friend on how to get out of debt. So you're not totally invested in the way that I am. What would be some of the techniques that you would use to help that person overcome our biases?
Exactly. Actually, BE Works tackled a question like this on a large scale. We worked with a Canadian financial institution looking at how to get people out of collections, but at the same time in a way that doesn't remove their sense of agency. And we use something that also gets people out to vote, which is very timely.
Yeah.
That is the implementation plan. So making it so that you focus on very specific actions you're planning to take. So in the case of voting, where are you going? What time? Who's going with you? Before work, after work? Is it, you know, you're walking there, whatever it would be. In the case of repayment, it could be as simple as indicating whether it's going to be in the next 24 hours, 48 hours, really trying to make it concrete for people. And then in combination, really getting them to pledge that this is something that they're committing to. And that kind of lets their, you know, their better feelings around maybe morality kick in and help to carry that through.
Which another way, I don't know, is another way of talking about pledging, goal setting.
Goal setting.
Is that similar
yeah.
or different?
I think it's very similar. Goal setting is something that also, you know, you need to think about how specific is that goal. And small steps can be incredibly powerful. In this case, what we're saying is let's get people to think about those next few hours in front of them and make something that's a realistic intention come to action.
Right. So on credit card, maybe goal for this month is the minimum payment. Goal for next month is $100.
Exactly.
Goal for the month after
Absolutely.
That is $110
yep.
or something like that.
Yeah.
One of the techniques that I have heard about is the notion of two bank accounts. So you've got one bank account for fixed expenses and one bank account for discretionary. Mm-hmm. What is the utility of that approach?
Yeah. So that is something that's called mental accounting. And it is something that is a very useful phenomenon to harness if you want to help people to save. And that's because people don't like to feel like they are not actually putting money into one account or another. So if you've got a couple of accounts in your savings, you know, frame of mind, then you'll sort of put money into more than one of them to make sure that you've covered them.
Right. And it also would seem like then you don't have to worry about paying your rent because it's already been it's already hidden away.
Yep.
You can't accidentally shop your way through your rent.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Automation is another big thing. And hopefully as fintech really becomes ingrained in the way that we operate as human beings, that could be a big step. What are some of the specific things that one would automate in an effort to reduce or eliminate consumer debt?
Okay, so automation is very interesting. That's been something that's been looked at with the use of defaults, for instance, in the pension industry.
Yep, save more tomorrow.
Save more tomorrow. But it has to be combined with other nudge tactics or other, you know, approaches to get people to engage in maybe like a habit, because that's really important. So you can't make everything sort of below the surface because then it means that people are not actually intentionally taking action in ways that help them. For example, in the pension example, it's around, you know, the contribution rate and whether that is something that ought to increase over time as somebody's salary increases, for instance.
One policy intervention in this country was to change the credit card bill, and they added that thing about how long it's going to take to pay off your credit card. And it's like, you know, if you pay the minimum payment, it's going to take you 60 months or whatever. Is that an effective change? Has that worked, or did someone just feel good about making a difference on credit cards?
Yes, I'm not privy to the research that went into that sort of a strategy, but I would figure that a good approach would be to really test it head to head with what's currently or previously the norm. So that would be, you know, an RCT, randomized control trial, is kind of the gold standard for knowing if something has worked. I do think, though, that other tactics can be useful in combination with something like that. For instance, the idea of impulse savings, which you could then translate into impulse payments to get rid of that debt load.
Roundup is something that has become much more common. It's
yep.
very easy on an investing front. Now, there are a couple of players. That's the idea that you buy a coffee and the extra 25 cents to round it up to $5 goes into investing. What's the research say on that approach?
That is something I'm not too aware about in terms of specific research.
Yeah.
But I can understand, you know, that there's something there about it being automatic. It's something that maybe is combined with, you know, it's the morning coffee. It's a little bit of a luxury. Therefore, I feel like extra impelled to do something that's good for myself long term. So
What is your view of the approach of going cash only? It is difficult to do in today's culture, but there is some data that illustrates the pain is higher mm-hmm. when you pay with a physical currency than a digital
yep.
one.
Yep. And that is something that's very interesting. We talked a lot about that, talked about this at my office quite a bit, actually, in terms of the tangibility of cash. And, you know, for one thing, in the area of savings versus spending, I think that, as you've said, when it's something that's tangible, you feel the pain of paying more. And then, of course, when we're putting money away, making it all the more tangible, maybe even like a piggy bank on the counter, if we could somehow make that so that it's, you know, even something that's virtual on your phone that you see every day, it would help to combat the conspicuous spending that we otherwise engage in.
credit card companies make their money based on a transaction fee and on the folks that don't pay off their balance every single month. It is a big, 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 big business. And there is not a great business case to, aside from people who default, but not a great business case for those credit card companies to help people pay that balance down. Mm-hmm. Are you broadly optimistic or broadly pessimistic about how Canadians will experience debt levels in the years to come?
Yeah, I think I'm optimistic because I think that people are becoming more and more aware of the fact that they do have biases that are working against them. And a lot of the clients that we work with at BEWorks are helping different industry leaders to figure out how to offer to Canadians or, you know, to consumers what they're looking for, which is to be nudged.
Nudge away. Well, Michelle, thank you for nudging us.
Thank you.
Michelle Hilscher is a senior associate at BEWorks. We're talking about behavioral economics and debt. Well, stay with us. Coming up later, Michelle will be back to go through a new segment called How I Do It. So stick around for that. But next, Krista Kerr, the CEO of Kerr Financial, will be here. She's going to tell us about this idea of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations and what you can do about it. You can follow me on Facebook at Bruce Celery Moolala or Twitter at Bruce Celery. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
As parents, we work very hard to both provide for our kids when they're kids, but also to set them up as best as we can to be functioning adults. And that second task is a bit different for high net worth families. There might be a significant nest egg that, if managed well, could serve many generations to come. Sadly, that doesn't always happen. Hence the phrase, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. This is a real phenomenon. So what to do about it? Krista Kerr is the CEO of Kerr Financial, an integrated wealth management firm. She's in Toronto today. Hi, Krista.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
So shirt sleeves is the Canadian version. In Japan, it's rice paddies to rice paddies in three generations. How would you characterize this in layman's terms?
Well, I think, as you say, it is very universal. Every culture has a variant of this. You know, in Ireland, they're saying clogs to clogs.
Right.
Three generations, so it can be anywhere. I think the concept or the fear I think that people have is that you, in your first generation, you build a business or a family nest egg, as you said, and you may have come from nothing and you've built something up, and then your next generation has, you know, better university and goes fancier houses and they spend more. And then, you know, they're not necessarily adding to the nest egg. And then the third generation, everybody is lavishly spending. Nobody is adding to the wealth. And all of a sudden it depletes and the fourth generation has to start all over again. I think that's the sort of the fear that people have is that they're going to maybe squander an opportunity that they have for their families.
A fear, but also wouldn't the data play this out? Isn't this pretty common in actuality?
It is actually very common. I think, you know, there have been a few recent studies that have shown that the wealthiest of families might take longer than three generations to completely deplete.
Right. Harder for Bill Gates' kids to burn through $50 billion or whatever that amount is.
Exactly. But there's many reasons why you can put pressure on that, you know, whether it's just from more people spending to other things like having, you know, families that can't functionally make decisions together and are suing one another like we see in the papers these days.
Well, the high profile story that we're talking about these days is the Stronix. And I'm sure you in your work see tough scenarios across the spectrum from, you know, challenging communication to all out nuclear war like we're seeing with the Stronix. What do families need to focus on from a communication standpoint? If we assert that a part of it is how they communicate as members of a family, what are the conversations that need to be had and when?
Yeah, and I think part of that, if you step back, you know, a family can say, I don't actually worry about keeping this together. I'm just going to spread my money apart. Everyone can make their own decisions. But if you start from the point of view that you as a family want to keep the family wealth together and you really want to make the best decisions and choices, then it's important to say that's really what our conscious choice is. And we want to look at the purpose of this money and we want to educate our next generations to be good owners in the future, and we want to have governance structures that help us make decisions together. So if you've made that decision, then I think it becomes a lot more about how, you know, right from early ages, you know, we use some resources about family education that show, you know, what should kids be learning when they're 5 and 6, you know, about the fact that money involves choices, and it's not just, you know, you get everything you want. You have to have choices. You can look at how you can use allowances, and then you get a little bit older, and how can they budget for themselves? How do they start learning about investments, et cetera? So I think if you have that purpose of wealth conversation with yourselves or your family, and you commit to this, then it becomes very important to look both at the stream of how do we help give our kids the tools to make good choices financially, and how do we start making decisions together, which can be things you can do around family charitable giving or around bank accounts or around gifts and how, you know, how they use allowances for different purposes, et cetera.
I was talking to a partner at a family office recently and asking what are the characteristics of families who do this well, who can sustain wealth over time. And she said one of the big factors is values. And often it is families who have some religion that they practice. Where would you net out on this idea of values? And what do you think fosters values within families?
Absolutely. Values are critical, I think. And you do tend to find it with families that are maybe together around a community activity or religion. But I think part of what we try to do, you know, if we're working with a family that has decided, yes, we want to keep money together as a family, one of the tools some people will use is a family foundation, for example, or a family pool of money that they're going to use for donations. And we've done a couple of good sessions where we bring the whole family together, even with kids as young as 12 or 13, and we start talking to them about, you know, what are the values that you remember being passed on to you by your parents and grandparents, and what values do you want to pass on to your children, and what are the experiences that you remember together that were really positive around either charitable giving or around financial choices, et cetera. So we get everybody to sort of share stories like that and build up a common view of what the family's values are. And then those values, you know, it's very easy to translate them to how are we going to give money together, but they actually have a broader purpose because they think really about, you know, how do we want to manage this money together as a family and what's important to us.
How do you foster hunger for people who don't actually have to work? Like they don't have to work because there is a trust fund, or at least someone's going to pay for the roof over their head, which might be in stark contrast to the parents or the grandparents who started the business who were working so hard because they literally had nothing. Is there a way to do that? I was talking to one guy who grew up in a high net worth family, and he said his dad intentionally left a quarter of the land uncared for by the landscaping crew. And so the kids all had to take care of that. And he said they didn't realize until they were adults that this was a technique. They thought it was like they didn't have enough money to pay the landscaper to do the whole lawn, so they had to do it. But are there ways to create artificial scarcity where in reality there is none?
Well, I think that's a big topic. I think the one common thing I would say about all of our families that we work with, or even all clients at all levels of wealth, is that they want to empower their kids, but they don't want to take away that desire to be productive, successful members of society. You know, that's a positive experience for people to have too. So I think part of it is that idea of right from the beginning, making sure people have to make a choice. So you don't always get, you know, even as a 5 or 6 or 8 year old, you don't just get whatever toy you want. You've always got to learn that, you know, it might be this or that. And then I think, you know, while you may have a lot of wealth set up, it may be set up in a way that you're only going to have so much that will pay for certain basic needs as opposed to you never having to work again. So I think part of it is that. I think part of it is also having that discussion about we need this money to last for future generations. And so you can't actually spend everything or there won't be anything left for your children and your children's children. So I think some of that, but I think also that idea of, you know, having people learn to manage on a budget, you know, so even though they might have unlimited resources in the trust, while they're going to university, they should know that they have a certain amount of money for that school year and they have to make it work.
And to pay for the private jet to Cabo, because that's not free. That's not free. Now, I want to ask you just before we go here, do you think the risks of this phenomenon are higher now or same or less than in the past? And I ask because there is this notion of entitlement, and I know the millennials hate that word, but we do certainly, regardless of age, we do certainly live in an era of immediate gratification in a way that we didn't before, regardless of how old you are. Do you think the risks are higher?
I think that is true. And I think it is not just generational. I think everybody looks for that big house or the big car. You know, not everybody's realizing that it isn't necessary to amass all those items to be happy.
Yeah.
So I think it is important if, you know, there's lots of ways you can perpetuate family wealth if you want to do it. And part of it has to do with, you know, what do we need to do to make sure this money lasts for a long time? How do we manage for taxes and inflation and positive returns? And let's consciously do that, and let's consciously work together to make sure, you know, we're doing the right estate planning so we're not facing extra taxes, and we're, you know, going to make positive decisions together so we're not going to sue each other in the future.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think there is a bigger risk because of that materiality of our society, and therefore it takes a bigger commitment to talking about those values up front and doing that education up front and working together to make sure things do last.
Really appreciate your perspective, Krista. Thank you.
That's my pleasure.
Krista Kerr is the CEO of Kerr Financial, an integrated wealth management firm. She was here to talk to us about multi-generational wealth and how to preserve it. We'll stay with us. Coming up next, Laura Paris from Shulman Law Firm will be here to tell us how to sort out all the accounts that you have to sort out when you're getting a divorce. And then we're going to talk with Michelle Hilscher from BE Works on a new segment we call How I Do It. If this isn't enough moolala for you, and who's kidding? Of course it's not enough. Download and subscribe to the podcast version of our show. It is on all of the various platforms out there, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you are going through a divorce, there's a pretty clear process for lots of it, like sorting out your joint bank accounts, your investments, and all that stuff. But there's a number of other accounts where things are less clear, like loyalty rewards accounts, and even like a shared iCloud account, for example. Laura Paris is a family lawyer at Shulman Law Firm, and she joins us now to talk about some of these other details which you might not have thought about. Hello, Laura.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Bank accounts get sorted out. There's a whole process, division of assets, all that kind of stuff. But let's start with this first example. How do loyalty programs get included in the division of assets?
So loyalty programs are considered the exact same way you'd consider any other asset. It is considered property and it is subject to division. So if
how do they value my 3,000 points or 300,000 points?
So it isn't considered as a cash value. It's actually considered at the source. So if it's Aeroplan miles, for example, you would split the Aeroplan miles in half. If you have 100,000, 50,000 would go to your spouse.
Okay, so that one's simple. Some of the other accounts that you talk about are things like an Apple ID or an iCloud account, or even our Amazon account if you pay for Amazon Prime. Why is that relevant? Why should we have those on our radar if one is going through a divorce?
So you want to be careful, you know, when you are separating, there's obviously a separation of two people who were living a life together. And there's certain things when you're taking different paths in life that you want to keep confidential or keep private, that your ex-spouse doesn't need to have that information about you. So when you're looking at other accounts such as an Apple ID or even, you know, something like an Amazon account, it's more to protect that confidentiality. And, you know, something like an Apple ID, for example, can actually be used if you have access to, you know, your ex-spouse's Apple ID. You have the ability to send messages on their behalf, send emails on their behalf. And that could actually convolute issues that you're dealing with in the context of your separation and lead to, you know, further incurrence of legal fees.
You could also buy the entire season of This Is Us and make them pay for it, which would be like $40.
You could do that.
$40. What about something like Amazon Prime, for example? It's a shared resource. You get books, you know, shipped to you for free if you have Prime, and you get to watch a whole bunch of TV series. Is that something that you need to, you know, divide up and set up your own?
You know, it's not necessarily. If you make the decision to maintain an account like that together, really the only thing that you would need to focus on is, you know, what credit card you're using when making these purchases and who's paying the annual fee. If it's something, you know, that you each are amicable and able to maintain that account together and it makes sense for you from a financial perspective to split those, you know, the annual fee for Prime or whatever it may be, you can make that choice. But for the most part, when you do separate, you, again, you are beginning to live a separate life. And if you if you need to start with, you know, accounts and separating those accounts, that's you know, one step to take to do that.
I'm sure things like changing the beneficiary on life insurance is on a checklist somewhere. You make sure that you do that. But what about removing a spouse's ability to trade in your investment account on your behalf, which is very common and you don't really think about it. It's not like a reminder that that exists.
You absolutely would want to take any sort of permissions that a spouse has in terms of your finances off. So, I mean, even if they have access to your online, you know, online banking, they may have the ability to make a transfer. They may have the ability to make a payment, even though they are not named on that account. The fact that they have access to your login credentials gives them the ability to, you know, make those transactions, which then will be difficult for you to prove was made by them,
right?
Because the transactions are being made in your name.
Tell me about passwords. I take this deep inhale of breath because many people in couples know the passwords of their spouse for lots of very good reasons. Do you have to go and change every single one?
I mean, you definitely would focus on the accounts that you are, you know, you use most often, the ones that could be potentially damaging to, you know, any sort of family law proceeding. We focus a lot on social media accounts and advising clients to change passwords related to their social media accounts. And the reason being is that social media creates, first of all, if there's certain posts that, you know, someone could, again, make on your behalf that they may then try to use against you in a family proceeding. Or there's also access to, you know, direct messages, things that maybe you're trying to keep private that, you know, a spouse could have access to. So definitely in that sense, when it comes to social media, we do advise, you know, to start changing those passwords.
You've said that you really need to be concerned about your credibility because it can cost you. That was the phrase that really struck me. What would be an example of that?
So, for example, you know, using a Facebook account, and if you have someone who, you know, has access to your Facebook account and perhaps makes a post on your behalf and then tries to use that post against you in the court proceeding. So, for example, maybe the post is something that's degrading against the opposite party. And they then use that in court to say, well, this is someone who's, you know, slamming me on social media. Maybe they're trying to use that as a way to say that you're not a fit parent. And then while it may not actually, you know, make a difference in terms of the final determination of that particular issue, what it does is it almost throws a wrench into the determination of the issue. And it adds an extra step that you have to take, another explanation that you have to make, which of course relates in further legal fees, which, you know, we all want to minimize as much as possible.
You want to earn them, but your clients want to avoid
them.
That's fair. You've got four steps to protecting your online reputation. Make a list of all joint accounts, remove personal info from accounts you no longer wish to use, purge and delete. Don't call out your ex on social media. Okay, that one seems to make sense. On the purge and delete, what's the thinking there?
So social media accounts, you know, people can have them for years. And things change in your life. You know, as you grow older, maybe before you weren't, when you first opened, you know, or activated your social media account, you were a teenager. You know, you were an early adult and you didn't have children. You had different views on life. There may be posts that you made at that time that you don't want coming out in you know, your family law proceedings now, because they may paint a picture of you that isn't actually an accurate reflection of who you are today.
Right.
So when it comes to purging and deleting, the model that we have with our clients is, if you're not comfortable with this particular post being presented before a judge, get rid of it.
I see. So you're talking about what could have been posted a decade ago that I wouldn't even know is on my social media account, because unless it popped up as a memory,
exactly,
I wouldn't know. So you recommend people go back and do due diligence through all their social media.
Absolutely.
Because of how it might be perceived in court.
Absolutely.
And this is admissible. This stuff's admissible.
It is. Yep, it is.
What is the number one thing that you wish couples knew about this realm here of separating accounts that they don't know? What is the number one piece of advice you would give to people who are embarking on the journey, the divorce journey?
When it comes to, you know, social media accounts and things that people post online, people tend to believe that it'll have a lot more of an effect on the way that their file, you know, transpires in the final determination or the final settlement than it actually does. Listen to your lawyers, focus on the issues that matter, and don't try to convolute things or, you know, throw mud just for the sake of doing it.
Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you for having
May
me.
None of my listeners ever need you or your services. Laura Paris is a family lawyer at Shulman Law. She was talking about some of the accounts that you need to be thinking about in a much more nuanced way. I am a big advocate for talking about money, not about specific numbers, but about values, goals, and process. This segment is called How I Do It, and it's a series of basic questions about how our guests manage their own personal finances. Now, I would not ask any question that I wouldn't answer myself. So our guest, Michelle Hilscher, she's a senior associate at BE Works, a management consulting firm that specializes in behavioral economics. And Michelle, I want just the first thing that comes to your mind.
Okay. This could be dangerous.
You buy coffee at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit?
Most often with debit.
Debit. And why? Why do you choose debit?
Because it's a small expense. And I feel that I do not want to add that onto my card for any reason other than, you know, that I can pay it immediately.
What do you still use cash for?
I use cash for when I'm going to the farmer's market.
Oh, because they don't necessarily have a swiper.
Very often, almost never, in fact.
So do you use cash for anything else? The farmer's market, which is not a year-round endeavor.
Exactly. When I go out of town, when I go bicycle touring, I like to have cash because that's like an emergency fund that's there if you need it and you can't get to an ATM.
Right. What about your financial life is automated? So bills, retirement savings, vacation savings, are you a highly automated person or a not super automated person?
I've automated certain things like bill payments, but there is still a lot that I like to do on my own.
What would be an example of what you like to do and why do you like to do that? Because I'm that way about my telecom bill. And the reason I'm that way about my telecom bill is because I've been what's the synonym for they haven't been super appropriate with me on my telecom bill. So I really have to go through it with a fine tooth comb. What do you not automate and why?
I do not automate impulse savings for myself. So what I will do is I'll program in a date each month where I look to see how I did. And then it's a specific time where I decide how much I'm putting into savings that's above and beyond what I normally would save.
Okay.
And it feels good because I know that it's coming. And yeah.
Is your base level savings automated?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So this is like the over and above.
Exactly.
Do you have overdraft protection on your bank account?
I do.
And why do you have overdraft protection on your bank account?
Well, I'm not going to go into that.
I have it because I've gone NSF before.
It's like you just want to make
happens.
Sure.
What are you nuts about when it comes to spending and what are you super duper casual about? So, for example, for me, I am nuts about groceries. Like I shop that store like I have 2 cents in my wallet and I shop the aisles. I look at the flyer and I have been super casual to my detriment on price comparing insurance. So for you, what are you nuts about? What are you not so nuts about?
Yeah, it's funny. I would say that certain things like, the grocery shopping, pet care, any of those things that are, you know, must-haves, I'd rather pay more. I'm not really looking to nickel and dime services like that. Whereas, I'm trying to think of something where
you shop at a farmer's market. I would buy something like as kind of a ceremonial purchase, but I wouldn't actually buy my groceries there.
Yeah, I think the farmer's market's not for everything, not all my produce. It's like that magical purple
carrot
or something like that.
The heirloom carrot.
Yeah.
Do you have an actual financial plan?
Do I have an actual financial plan?
Yeah.
No, I don't. And that's the funny thing is that I ought to, because that's one of my big, big recommendations a lot of times.
I didn't have one till I was in my 40s. And I've been covering this for a very, very long time. Who manages your investments? DIY, robo, full service financial advisor?
That's more of a DIY.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I started with a financial advisor and then moved to DIY over time. What would you say are things that are in your portfolio? Is it mutual funds, ETFs, bonds, art, classic cars, comic books?
Not going to go there.
No.
Nope.
Do you or would you ever hold an income property?
Would I hold an income property? Possibly, yeah.
What would be exciting about that and what would be terrifying about that?
I think it would be terrifying to actually manage the day-to-day on that if you actually, needed to make sure that it's maintained through the winter, shoveling the snow off the roof, that sort of thing. But then the use of the property and just imagining the possibility.
Landlords often talk about getting the 2 a.m. phone call, and I realize I don't have my ringer on in the night, so I wouldn't be able to receive the 2 a.m. phone call. I'd be asleep.
Yep.
What would you say has been your best financial move? Would it be your education?
Yeah, I mean, my education, probably. Yeah, it's been a big investment. But I think more so it's getting into the market here in Toronto with my home when I did.
Ah.
Yeah.
I remember back in 2002 looking at real estate in Toronto and thinking, these prices are ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm not. No, I could never see paying a house, paying a price for a house in 2002. Yeah. Oops. At least I moved to New York City. And so it wasn't, I really didn't have that opportunity. Who files your taxes? Do you do your own taxes? Do you have a, you do your own taxes?
I do my own taxes.
Wow.
It's fun.
Wow. Good for you. Good for you. If there is one area where you think you'd like, I'd like to get a bit better at that, what would be that area?
I think it would be around household budgeting, because I do think sometimes there I slip.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your level of disclosure. I think it's really helpful for people to just talk openly about how we do things. And thank you for doing that with us.
It's fun.
Michelle Hilscher is a senior associate at BE Works, and that's how she does it. Well, that's our show for today. If you have a comment or a question or a story idea, send us a note to ask@moolala.ca. And if you want to learn more about my approach to getting a handle on my money and yours too, you could buy a copy of one of my books. The first one is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Thanks very much for joining us, and have a great day.